of airborne illness. It's not an all-the-time thing, but for when you're around a lot of people indoors. 4. Stay home if you're sick and get tested for COVID-19. Talk to your provider or call 212-COVID-19 for Paxlovid or other treatment options. And 5. And as always, keep those hands clean. Spread cheer, not COVID or the flu, New Yorkers. After all we've been through, we all deserve a healthy and peaceful holiday.
The Vision Zero Initiative reminds you that speeding ruins lives. Drivers, always look for pedestrians and cyclists and slow your turns to 5 miles per hour.
Hey, truck drivers, here's a safety tip to know before you go. Trucks turn safest at 5 miles per hour. When turning, make sure there's no pedestrians or cyclists in your blind spots. Help keep New York City streets safer for everyone this holiday season. Visit nyc.gov/TruckSmart.
Stay tuned for Live on the Fly with Randy Credico here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
We need Julian Assange. And one thing I want to say to you today is it is not only that he is the victim of torture, it is not only that his life is at stake, it is not only that we want to save him from a dreadful injustice, we also want to save him because the world needs Julian Assange as a symbol and fighter for liberty in these times.
Anton Karas, the third man, for 6 years now, as if I need to say that. That was Craig Murray, the former ambassador from the UK to Uzbekistan, in a speech that he made back in 2019 at St. Pancras Church. And Craig is in Hamburg today, and he's going to be joining us the second half of this show. This is definitely Live on the Fly today, Craig is at a opening in Hamburg of the Gabriel Shipton film Ithaca, along with Stella Assange. So right after the Q&A, we're going to get him in here at 3:30, 9:30 their time. I'm Randy Credico. This is Randy Credico Live on the Fly here on 99.5 FM in New York City. I just we do have a packed show. Jill Stein, if it weren't for Hillary Clinton, would be president today. If she had just gotten out of the way, we would have Jill Stein in her second term. So she'll be joining us real shortly. I just want to make this announcement tomorrow at 1 p.m. in front of the U.K. consulate, the U.S.'s largest colonies consulate on 47th and 2nd, U.K. There will be a demonstration, a vigil, rally, whatever. And we got a lot of great speakers there, including Roger Waters, and Joe Lauria is going to be there, and he's there. He's with us right now. But before we get to him, I just want you to get there at 1 o'clock tomorrow, and let's all behave. This is a critical moment for Julian Assange, and so I hope. And I want to give a shout out to NYC Free Assange, because they've been working. We've been working together on this for the last 3 weeks, and it's been a lot of work, folks, a lot of work. And they've been very professional, as always. So a shout out to Chuck and to Bernadette. All right. So we'll talk about this with Joe. Is Joe there? Joe Lauria?
Joe is here.
Joe is here. Right. Joe, you're coming up. You and Max Blumenthal and Garland Nixon are all coming up, and Nick Brana are all coming up, or three or four. I don't know. I know three are coming up tomorrow for this event. Why is it so important, Joe, for you to make this trek up to New York City for this event tomorrow?
Well, we're at a very interesting point in this very long saga of Julian Assange. There's a lot of drama building. We've seen some interesting developments in the last week. It's time to actually particularly point out the role of the British government, but we saw five newspapers that Julian Assange partnered with back in 2010 to publish the war logs and the Afghan war logs and the diplomatic cables. And none of those five newspapers were indicted, even though they published the same material Julian Assange did. Only Assange was published for those same documents coming out. And those newspapers finally put out a letter last week in which they called on the Biden administration to drop the charges on Assange. Clearly, they know that they should have been indicted too, but they haven't been. That led John Young, the founder of Krypton.org, rather. John Young stated on Twitter that he sent a submission to the Justice Department asking to be indicted, to be a co-defendant with Julian Assange, because he, in fact, had the same documents Assange did. He even had access to the unredacted diplomatic cables, and he published them before WikiLeaks did. And he wants to know why he wasn't questioned, why he hasn't been arrested, why he hasn't been charged, and why Assange has, and that he also should be charged. That has led to a I am Spartacus moment, if you remember that scene in the film, where the commander asks these captured right. slaves who rebel to stand forward, who was Spartacus, and they all stand and say that they're yeah. Spartacus. That led Dan Ellsberg just the other day to do the same. He told the BBC Hard Talk program that he had been given, he had never told anyone this before, he'd been given a backup file of everything Chelsea Manning had given to WikiLeaks, and he had possession of it. That's classified material, defense information. He had unauthorized possession of it at the same time Assange did before WikiLeaks published. He has asked the government to indict him as well.
Do you want to be indicted too? Why don't you and I throw our hat into the ring?
Yes,
that's I am. Hey, wait a second. I do a Kirk Douglas from Spartacus. I'm Spartacus. All right, let's go after the Romans. All right, Joe, that's great. And it's there's so many things wrong with this case, but it doesn't seem to propel the Justice Department to drop the charges, whether it be this guy Ziggy, whether it be the spying by UC Global, whether it be the FOIA revelations that Stefania Moritzi got, the assassination attempts, all this stuff doesn't seem, it's spaghetti on the wall, hits the ground, and they're just going through with it because they do not want him to be talking. Let's be honest. This is a tough row to hoe at this point. It really is. And that's why you're coming up to New York this week to continue. We have to continue to mobilize and speak out, and we cannot rest. And I know you are not, and you have an article in the Consortium News in which you are the managing editor. You released today, and people, please tune in to Consortium News, Joe Loria. Joe, I want you to stick around. I'm not pushing you off. I want you to stick around because we need you here today. So somebody on your board at Consortium News is going to be joining us right now in just 1 minute. I got to play a quick piece of music and come back with the great Jill Stein in just like 1 minute. I need to do something.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
When the union's inspiration through the workers' blood shall run, there can be no power greater anywhere beneath the sun. Yet what force on earth is weaker than the feeble strength of one? But the union makes us strong.
Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. Solidarity forever. For the union makes us strong.
All right, Pete Seeger. Solidarity forever. I'm Randy Credico, Randy Credico live on the fly here with Reggie Johnson, the crack engineer here at the station for many years. And he actually was here when we kicked off the Assange Countdown to Freedom program back April 11th of 2017 with Julian Assange and John Pilger. Okay, it's been 6 years since I've had Jill Stein on this show. And when I had her on the first time, also on the show, was Craig Murray. Craig Murray. And so the two of them are on together today. Also, Joe Loria is with us today. And Craig may have some problems, I don't know, with the connection. He is in Hamburg. So we got my co-pilot, Joe, who's hanging out here. And I appreciate that, Joe. Don't go anywhere. Jill, thank you for coming back. It's been way too long. Jill there? I don't know. I think we lost Jill. All right. We're going to have to call Jill back. Jill, so continue what you were saying about this event tomorrow. You are coming up for it. And the reason is that you want to continue to show your support for Assange and you want to get other people involved.
The case has to be explained over and over again. Those five newspapers that said to the Biden administration, drop the case. I think there was a reaction to that. Michael Hayden, who was a former CIA NSA director, he has a center out here at the George Mason University in Fairfax, Virginia, and he rented the grand ballroom of the National Press Club last Monday, and he brought on FBI guys and other people who were there to hit piece against Julian. They did invite Barry Pollack, Assange's U.S. lawyer. And he did a brilliant job calmly laying out all the facts of the case. And one example is he said Assange, the indictment against Assange does not say that he tried to hack the computer. And it also says Chelsea Manning had complete security clearance to get every document she needed. She didn't need Assange to help get him there. What Assange was trying to do was to hide her identity, as any journalist would do with his source. And by the way, he was unable to do it. So after he said that, this guy, Holden Triplett, who was a former FBI agent in the U.S. and abroad, and he was also in the Trump National Security Council as the counterintelligence person, he just completely ignored everything that Barry Pollack said and proceeded to say that Assange hacked into the computer to get the documents. He heard what he said. He read the indictment.
Right.
He knows that the public has not read the indictment, so that he can continually push forward this disinformation.
Right. You know, listen, if they're relying on people like Mark Zaid and this guy Triplett and Sterling Hayden, I'm just joking, this guy, General Hayden, then if that's what they're relying on for the other side, then I think Julian's in pretty good shape when it comes to this country. If that's those are the people to do the PR for the Pentagon and the CIA. Jill Stein has rejoined us. I think we lost you for a minute. Are you there, Jill?
I am. Yes, I am indeed. And it's really wonderful to be with you and with Joe Loria. So thank you so much for having me on.
Well, I must. It's been 6 years. I was just saying it's been 6 years since you were last on this show. And it was with Craig Murray, who's going to be joining us in about 20 minutes. and I was saying, you know, in the very beginning, I don't know if you heard it, if Hillary Clinton had just stepped out of the way, if the Democratic Party had just folded the tent like they should have done, you would be a president in 2016. And let me ask you this, Jill. Isn't what we're seeing right now with this Biden administration what we would have seen in 2017 if Hillary had won in 2016? Isn't this the story we would have seen, what we're getting right now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if not worse, because Hillary was begging for a no-fly zone over Syria. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes.
So, you know, it could have really come to loggerheads. In a big way. I mean, it could be all over. We might not be here now, you know, if Hillary had her way. And I don't mean to imply that, you know, these are personalities that are really driving this, but the personalities really reflect a state of crisis, really, in our democracy and everything that depends on it. And, you know, whether it's Joe Biden or Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump, for that matter, you know, our elections are generally this farce in which you vote against the person that you hate the most, and real representatives of the public interest, people who would provide health care as a human right that would save us $500 billion a year, you know, people that would respect workers and not crush their right to strike and their right to decent employment, which is going on right now on the part of supposedly the most progressive Democrats that are out there. They are crushing labor as as both parties have, but certainly the Democrats have been fully a part of that for decades, and the expanding war and the resurgent nuclear weapons. Democrats are equal partners with Republicans right now in all the things that are really putting our lives on the line. So, you know, it's really important that we continue this fight back.
Well, what's the answer? I mean, are we just going to stay strung out like a drug addict on the thinking that the electoral process is going to get us into a high that we're going to win? I mean, the third party option is no. It was okay in the 1850s and 1860s, but it doesn't seem like up until the Bull Moose Party in 1908. But it doesn't seem like anything. I don't see it on the horizon that it can actually happen in this country the way things are so rigged. What is the alternative? Or do we stay addicted to the electoral process to realize some type of change here?
You know, I think the empire has to expend incredible energy on all fronts, all the time, in order to suppress the rebellion that is actually going on right now in a big way. And I think, you know, that is kind of the goal, is to strategically empower this rebellion. And that's what you and the Assange folks are doing on Saturday, you know, helping people understand why the attack on Assange is really an attack on us all. It's an attack really on the foundations of democracy, on our right to a free press, on human rights, on the judicial system, which it makes a total mockery of. You know, we're all at risk here. You know, this really is a Spartacus moment, not just, you know, in the acting of it. It's really true. We all are Julian Assange here. We're not taking it quite on the on the knees the way he is right now, but we are all in the crosshairs on this. And the same thing is true with our political system across the board. It's not getting fixed, and people really are in revolt in the same way that labor, you know, is really in crisis right now with the latest assault in this war on working people that's been going on for so long. And it's a big wake-up moment, and, you know, it's like the walls are closing in, whatever direction you look in. If you're looking at jobs, if you're looking at healthcare, if you're looking at student debt or medical debt, or you know, or the climate and your hope to survive. If you are a Gen Xer and you're thinking you might be here more than 30 or 40 years, it's really important for us to engage people at the level of their self-interest and for us to work together. And that's the little thing, the little shindig we're having here.
Yes, tomorrow.
And on Saturday. Yes, and that's the reason why I won't be there in the flesh, but I am with you in New York in the spirit. And here in Boston, we are doing an event in real time here and space, but we're also doing this on Zoom. So when you get done.
What time does it start?
It starts at 3 and it runs till 5:30. So you can
Perfect.
Join us online, and we will be tweeting it out soon and also getting out by email. So, you know, tune in. And this is really about building this kind of convergent organizing that we need to do, because divided we are conquered, and we're all desperate within our various silos. You know, whether you're fighting on the climate or on Assange and democracy issues or labor and the economy, you know, or the war and nuclear weapons, you know, we are all very much up against the wall right now. And I think people are really experiencing a moment of unprecedented desperation, just looking at sort of the dire developments, which are not coincidental. You know, this is kind of the logical conclusion of empire and end-stage capitalism, you know, corporatism, call it what you will. But I think people are getting the point right now. You know, it's not working. And it's not that it's just not working. It's that our survival really is not compatible with this level of existence here for very much longer.
Right. You know, you said we really have to be united right now. We have to be united on this Assange front, but we also have to be united, all of us, from all the different, struggles. We really do, because yeah. I want to play this speech by Bill Kunstler. It's only a minute long. After Kent State, they indicted 25 students there on a conspiracy charge. And Bill was the first lawyer down there after the shootings, and then he came back there to bring money from the National Lawyers Guild, and he made this speech. It's actually a 25-minute speech, but this is the gist of it, and people really need to absorb what he says here.
The greatest error that the German people made was they couldn't recognize the threat of boots until the boots were outside the door. They couldn't recognize that in a matter of months, a country that produced Beethoven and Liszt and Schumann and Goethe would be on the trail of making lampshades out of human skin. That a year after Hitler's accession, there would be a place known as Dachau. And 4 years later, Buchenwald and then Treblinka, Auschwitz and all the rest. That 22 million people would eventually die because people could not get together when there was time to get together. You've got to be one. I just can't stand anymore the idea that we can't be one when we're attacked. And I don't give a damn what you are, whether you're Weatherman or ACLU. The point is, when oppression starts fighting at those who are the most vulnerable, it never stops until it chews up the middle. And I hope the middle recognizes that. Because the occupants of concentration camps were not just the communists before it ended. And that's what could happen anywhere.
Your thoughts about that it's rare because we just found it and Reggie just dug it up. Your thoughts, Jill?
Wow. I couldn't catch every word just because of the blurring, you know.
Right, it's
here, but you know, it's wonderful and powerful, and you know that we need to get together, and that basically we are facing dire threats. And he's making the analogy to, you know, just before the Second World War and the horror of, you know, fascism, and you know, there's a lot of truth in this. You know, the fascist threat that is developing right now. And I think what's really important, you know, is to know that that fascist threat is not just the Republicans, but that
right.
fascist threat is the Republicans as a response to neoliberalism,
right.
you know, and neo-fascist. And that's why I think the Democrats' hype, I shouldn't say it's hype, because there's a lot of validity to, you know, to the alarms being sounded by Democrats about what Republicans are doing, but they're only catching half the problem, because they're, you know, they are full on corporate control and control of the banks and money and just, you know, excluding political competition. And you can't have democracy, you know, halfway. You have to address the many, very vicious threats and takedowns to democracy, which are really bipartisan, and especially the economics that are being perpetrated by the Democrats, and you know the rule of the banks and the Wall Street bailouts
and the military
all that goes with that, and absolutely the military, where the Democrats are now leading the charge, which is all of which underscores, I think, what you were saying. This is why we need to be getting together, and it's worth remembering that. The you know, the security state, the, you know, the predator state, empire, whatever you want to call it, they expend an incredible amount of energy, much of it covertly, to keep us divided, and it's just really important for us to bear that in mind, because there are a lot of challenges in trying to stay unified and build coalitions. There are a lot of challenges, but it's really important that we keep it going, because there is no alternative here. And in the same way that the railway worker union now, they are calling for unity among labor and really unity across the board, as well as independence from the two corporate political parties. So that's a huge breakthrough. And I think those breakthroughs are happening all over the place right now, you know, because reality is closing in. The climate, you know, fossil fuel emissions and the profiteering that this war has enabled, you know, is really very directly in the hands of the Democrats. You know, Joe Biden told us that, you know, before they blew up the pipeline that we had, or was it his Secretary of State, you know, one or the other, but they were repeatedly saying that we have so much to benefit here by sabotaging Russian oil. You know, this is kind of the ultimate war for oil that's going on right now. And, you know, much of it enabled by Democrats who've really been leading the charge in this latest proxy war. You know, so there's a lot of wake-up moments now that I, at least I'm seeing, I don't know if you are too, where people who've been sort of hanging on by a thread to these fantasies that the Democratic progressives were going to save us, you know, it's now so clear, especially after they sabotaged the railway workers union and really just, you know, gave them a direct punch in the gut, you know, that they are not going to be allowed to strike here, co-signed by the squad, you know, the progressive squad. So people are really...
Well, I'll never call myself a progressive again. I am not a progressive because it's like it used to be a liberal, then that turned out to be a bad word. Then you're a progressive. Now that has been co-opted, and it's a bad word. So I guess say radical. But I'm sure Chuck Schumer is going to be calling himself a radical soon. So I don't know where I'm going to go. Now, listen, Joe, we're going to try to get a hold of Craig Murray and Joe. Now, Joe, I'm going to throw the ball to you because you're a journalist. I'm just a comedian radio host. And so I'm sure you have something to ask Jill. So go right ahead.
Well, Jill, that was interesting what you said about the Hillary Clinton administration may have been actually worse than Biden's, but a lot of us were saying at the time during the 2016 election that if Hillary Clinton were elected, there could be war with Russia. And, of course, that was ridiculed. And here we are. The Biden administration is running this proxy war against Russia. And also people said that if Hillary were elected, there could be a risk of nuclear war with Russia. Mm-hmm. The tensions from Russiagate were the beginning of this problem, and people, and Bob Perry, the founder of Consortium News, wrote an article back in 2014 saying that, are you ready for nuclear war over Ukraine? And he pointed out how Russiagate was creating that tension. So I wonder, what else about the Biden administration do you think has disappointed you, if there's all, or did you expect them to be as bad as they are?
Oh, I knew better than to have any expectations whatsoever. Joe Biden told us in plain English, nothing will change, you know, which is what he said to Wall Street. And that is his one promise, really, that he has fulfilled, you know, not the $15 minimum wage, not the public option on health care, not even the pharmaceutical benefits, which, you know, there's all this hype about. But what actually is it? You know, well, they do have a cap on insulin starting on January 1st, but that's it. You know, there are 10 pharmaceuticals that will be eligible for bulk purchasing starting in 2 years from now, basically. You know, it's just like, it's ridiculous. So they have not delivered, and it has actually fulfilled my expectations that the, you know, the predator is just going to keep revealing themselves here. And I don't just mean Democrats. I mean, you know, corporate-sponsored politicians who are serving the war industry and Wall Street. And I think that veil continues to lift. Randy,
the only difference may have been that...
Yeah, sorry. Yes, we're listening.
Yeah, go ahead.
Did you ask me something?
I think the only difference...
Go ahead, Joe.
She was asking whether you want to resume...
We're going to continue. Yes,
I
don't mind standing back a little bit. I'm trying to practice for tomorrow where I say very little and
okay.
keep the show going. You know, I'm the MC, but I don't want to do a lot of time in between. But what I do have to do is take a quick musical break and get a station ID. You guys hold it right there. I'm not sure Craig is still inside at the theater, I think, but I'm glad you're both here. Can you stick around? You don't have to go anywhere, do you?
Yeah.
Okay.
All right.
This is Live on the Fly, folks. It happens. You know, you can always pre-record and edit these things, and sometimes I do, but I like it live. So this is Lotta Lania, since Craig is in Germany singing Mack the Knife from Three Penny Opera. We'll be right back. We'll play like a little pastiche of it.
Blauen Sonne.
right. That is the late, great La Dolina. I love that tune. And I like the version she did one time with Louis Armstrong. She sang it with Louis Armstrong one time in English. I'm Randy Credico. This is Live on the Fly here on Free Speech Radio. And by the way, 99.5 FM WBAI, the Pacifica Network. Jill, I wanted to ask you that. I was going to ask you earlier, how important is it to maintain the function of this station, the viability of this station, because we are under attack?
Yeah. I think you've been under attack for a long, long time. That, you know, public interest communications are, you know, are on the top 10 wanted list, I think, of the empire, because communications is what makes democracy possible. And as our communications become more and more corporatized and censored and propagandized, it is impossible for us to function as a democracy, to fight the war, to, you know, stand up for our labor struggles, whether it's Starbucks or Amazon or the rail workers. You know, we really need the word to be getting out, or whether it's the student debt strikers. We really rely on public interest radio. So please pony up, everybody.
Yes, it's not just public radio. This is listener supported. This is not NPR. Mm-hmm. There's a qualitative difference between this
and they're not even public.
No, especially in this city. NPR is basically, I don't see much difference between NPR and it should say National Security State Public Radio, because I don't see a big difference between them and MSNBC. And I watched it for the first time, MSNBC, since the since the proxy war started. And and they've been gaslighting for the last 8 months. It's like this. You see Jim Acosta on CNN. You see Ken Delanian on the other channel. And it's the same stuff. It's like it's never changed. It's never changed. You got five talking heads. It reminds me of the McLaughlin group, where you got five points of view: the right, the far right, the extreme right, the fascist right, and the Third Reich. That's what you have with the and that's all they have. Five talking heads all saying the same thing. You had
and I think what has changed, though, is that their ratings are crashing. You know, it really took kind of the Trump paranoia of the last many years and Russiagate to kind of drive people into a frenzy and maintain their ratings, which have probably had a lot to do with why they kept, you know, they remained a one song, you know, a one hit wonder, kind of all Trump.
Russiagate.
The time.
You and I were both tied into that Russiagate deal. The ludicrous allegations that Roger Stone had any back channel, and then linking him to me as a back channel. There are a lot of people who bought that. Chris Hayes is the first one to bark it out there on MSNBC. We've got the missing link, as if Julian Assange would ever give anything to Roger Stone. Something that he has, something that he's sitting on, the greatest story ever told. He said, oh, wait a second, let me tell Roger Stone about this. It was so ridiculous. And then you get swung into the and smeared into this whole Russiagate affair. How did it affect you? And I want to go to Joe right after that and ask him the same question I asked you about public radio.
I've learned to kind of developed the FDR attitude, you know, which was like, I welcome their hate, you know, from the banks. I sort of feel that now towards, you know, I welcome the sneers almost, because, wow, they make me so relevant. They confer on me such incredible power to determine elections and all kinds of other things that I'm being held responsible for. You know, and it's a joke, you know, to read social media and Twitter. It really doesn't have traction anymore, except, you know, among the Hillbots. And when I get big smears, usually there are lots of people, you know, pushing back and, you know, really fighting with real information. So it doesn't, you know, I would be much happier without it, and I would feel secure, because occasionally I feel, you know, like there's a danger out there appearing in public places and stuff, but not for the most part. You know, it kind of feels like it's had it today.
Joe, I'm going to have that's a great answer. Joe, I'm going to have to postpone that question or just kick it down the road here, because we do at last have the ex-ambassador, author, historian, human rights crusader in Hamburg. Craig Murray is here.
Hello there, then.
Hello.
And hello, Jill.
You got Jill? Hey. You two are together again for the second time.
Yeah, it's a big reunion moment here. Some things don't change.
All right. Well, we also have Joe Loria on. And Craig, so you are in Hamburg right now. We've been discussing all sorts of issues here. You know, how bad the situation is in the U.S. I suppose you don't consider it anymore. You're not much more optimistic about things in your own country or in Europe.
No. I've been touring Germany for the last month, really, on the Assange campaign. And it's fascinating. The German railways, which used to be very, very good, are now in a terrible state because of privatization. I've left Stuttgart, where people are campaigning because the entire central area has been demolished where the railway was in order to make money for property developers. I've been speaking at communes and art centres, which are being closed down to make way for corporations. But basically, wherever you go, you come across the same same dreadful imposition of capital on people's lives.
Right. Well, so let me ask you this. Are the people there that are in dire straits, are they out there beating the drums for war with Russia and spending money, you know, to give to Zelensky? Is that what they're doing out there? Or are they looking for some security at home and for jobs and a better life altogether?
Well, I think there's a very strong anti-war movement here in Germany. I mean, because I've been out and about with activists and with Assange campaigners and talking to audiences who were interested in the case of Julian Assange and in questions of freedom and press freedom, I don't claim I've met a representative sample of people, but what I can say is that there's definitely a very, very strong movement here in Germany that doesn't want a major war in Europe and wants to see a negotiated peace settlement, doesn't want to have the energy insecurity that this war entails. The people here are, I think, pretty sick of the war. There have been some very big demonstrations here against the war.
All right, we are joined by Joe Loria. I don't know if you've interviewed Craig before, but Joe, you were there. I was there at Belmarsh during the first phase of the. It wasn't a trial, but the hearing there. And so I'd like you to chime in here again, and you know, pose a question to Mr. Murray, the ambassador. Joe, are you still there? I think we may have lost Joe, so I have no idea. So, Jill, why don't you jump in and give Mr. Murray a query here while we try to get Joe back on the phone.
I just want to say how much the people who are fighting for Assange, fighting for democracy, fighting for peace, fighting for our survival, we so, you know, just really have such a warm place in our hearts for you, Craig, and for all your work and your tireless eloquence and just moral presence, your commanding moral presence. Thank you so much for that. It's just really a joy to hear and, you know, see everything that you're putting out. And I want to agree with what you said, that there's a lot of anti-war sentiment, and I wonder. You know, I did see on Twitter the results of a poll. It wasn't Claire Daly. It was the other socialist in the European Parliament who had posted this, and it seemed pretty, reliable. But basically there was twice as many people who, and this was a EU-wide poll back, earlier in the fall, I think, or maybe the end of the summer. And even at that time, before energy prices had really hit home in a big way, even at that point, it was like a 2-to-1 majority or plurality, I guess, 2-to-1 that people who really wanted a negotiated peace, even if it meant making concessions and giving up territory, people wanted peace and not war. And it just strikes me that this is so much of a piece with what's going on with Assange. He's being silenced and has to remain silenced because, you know, he gives voice to really to the public interest and to the public's fervent, you know, desire for a peaceful coexistence and a world we can survive in.
Yeah, and I think what's, and one of the things that's fascinating about that is there's such a huge gap between the unanimous cheerleading of the state and corporate media for the war, and it is cheerleading for the war, an absolutely blatant propaganda that's almost laughable at times. There was an article in The Guardian yesterday or 2 days ago by the Ukrainian culture minister asking people to boycott Tchaikovsky and Tolstoy. I actually thought it was a spoof at first, but this was quite serious. But there's such a gap between this extraordinary media propaganda, which is unanimous, and what people think. You know, the propaganda doesn't always work, and I find that very, very interesting.
Okay. All right, we got you. All right.
Yeah, and I don't know, you know, where you were when the wall came down in Berlin, but I know Chris Hedges always describes how right up to that moment, the kind of pro-democracy community was all saying, maybe in 10 years there would be some progress. And then suddenly, like in the course of a week, what had been sort of weekly small gatherings just went ballistic. And, you know, and the East German regime came down quickly. So, I don't know. Yeah, where were you around then? And, you know, have you seen this before, I guess is what I'm saying. Have you seen kind of this veil that is, you know, this this consent, this manufactured consent? It's extremely expensive and time-intensive to maintain that manufactured consent, and reality keeps breaking through all the time. And I guess I'm just saying, have you seen that before in your experience, that all of a sudden things break through?
I saw it almost work in the first referendum we had on Scottish independence, where at the start of the campaign, in support for independence was at 28%, and by the end of the campaign we ended up at 45%, and at one stage we were over 50% in the polls, but that was against an absolutely unanimous media on the other side. You simply had a street campaign. You know, you had town meetings and individuals talking to each other, and you had this massive shift in public opinion going totally against what they were being told on the television every night and in every newspaper. Yeah. And that was that didn't quite succeed in making it over the line, but it was a most tremendous social movement to be a part of, and it was a feeling of rebellion, this feeling of rejection of what you were being told, and this feeling of distrust of what you were being told, which was really, really interesting to me.
All right, I'm going to jump in here for a second because we're going to get Joe back on because I know he has a question for. But first, I'm going to play something that will be banned possibly in this country. This 30 seconds of some wonderful classical music from the 30s. right. That was Dmitry Shostakovich, soon to be banned in the U.S. and the U.K. and other NATO countries. I'm Randy Critical, Randy Critical, live on the fly. But I'm playing that every week in defiance, Craig. So I hope I have your approval. I know, Joe, you had a question that you wanted to ask Craig, so hop to it, my friend.
Great. Yeah.
Thank you.
Wait. I got Joe asking a question here.
Sorry. I thought you said Jill. I'm sorry. Easy to confuse them. Go ahead. Sorry.
I got to enunciate.
Thank you, Randy. Craig, just about an update on Julian Assange's situation. There's been a lot of movement with the five newspapers coming out with their letters saying to the Biden administration that they should drop the case. We've got John Young of Cryptome and now Daniel Ellsberg were saying indict me because I had the documents as well. Why are you only going after Julian Assange? And, of course, the Assange team has filed with the European Court of Human Rights in case something goes wrong in Britain. That's the backup. We are expecting the High Court of England and Wales soon to be deciding whether they will accept at least some of the points. My question to you is that still the optimism? When I spoke to Stella in London a couple of months ago, she expected at least some of the points to be allowed by the High Court. And another question, because I'm going to speak about this in New York tomorrow in front of the British consulate and the British UN mission on Second Avenue. What is Britain's independent role in this? We learned so much about how they celebrated his arrest in the embassy. Is just Britain not being a vassal of the U.S. here, but actually being a driving force to get Julian sent to the U.S.?
Craig?
Yeah. Well, on the first point, yeah, I was... with Stella here a couple of days ago, and I'll be joining her again in a few days' time, and she's sort of coming in and out of the tour. We expected to hear from the High Court before now that they would hear the appeal on at least some of the points of the appeal. We didn't think it would take them this long to make a decision simply on whether they're going to hear it or not. And in fact, at one stage, we thought it's quite possible that the actual hearing may take place before Christmas. And that's obviously impossible now, and it's looking increasingly unlikely we'll get a decision on whether they'll hear it before Christmas. This, of course, is part of the process, part of the punishment, because Julian's in the maximum security prison all this time. And there's no time pressure on them. They can wait till March to make a decision on whether they're going to hear it, and then they can wait till August till they hear it, and all that time he's still in the maximum security jail. So, part of this is the toying with him aspect of the whole thing. The appeal that's been lodged with the European Court related to the points on which the High Court already made a decision is effectively intended to make certain that there can't be an immediate, quick extradition. Because one other thing that theoretically can happen is that the High Court may come back on Monday and say, no, we have decided now we're not going to hear an appeal. And they could try that afternoon to get him on a plane to the United States before any other legal intervention could happen. Mm. So the appeal to the European Court, lodging that already, is in part designed to preclude that possibility. These things go day by day, and it's a process in which we are not in charge of any part of the timetable. The authorities are, and we'd absolutely stopped believing in any kind of judicial independence around this. I think anyone who thinks the judges are acting independently is a fool. this is very much a politically controlled process. On the UK position and the UK's eagerness to have him arrested and its role in promoting that action against him, I don't think you should take it as the UK acting
independently in any way. I think it's simply the UK wanting to be seen by the United States to be proactive and to be a really good little ally and look what we're doing for you, rather than waiting to be ordered to do things, if you like. So I think it simply is an aspect of the subservience of the UK to the United States, but that doesn't preclude it from doing independent initiatives or along lines of which it thinks the United States has already approved.
You know, Craig, I wanted to ask you, because you've been around Stella, and everyone is deeply concerned because you don't get much news about the general condition of Julian, either emotionally or physically or psychologically. Do you have any insight on that you could share, or do you want to push it off for another time?
I don't think there is any particular news in that sense. I mean, we remain extremely concerned about the effect that the conditions he's kept in on his mental health and his long-term well-being, because he's kept in conditions no one should be kept in. You know, and the worst of terrorists are kept in those conditions, and they shouldn't be either kept in those conditions. No human being should be. It would be illegal to keep a dog like that. The concern is very much about the effect of all this upon his long-term well-being and his mental health. There's no, to my knowledge, there's no further or immediate deterioration in his physical health. There have been periods where, you know, his physical health has, and you've seen it in court, Randy, you know, where his physical health has been plainly deteriorating before our eyes. I don't believe there's any immediate worry about his physical health, although there are already permanent long-term effects on his physical health from what he's been through.
That was 3 years ago, February 23rd, that I last saw him. And as you said, the situation was chilling to watch him behind that glass door as a glass bulletproof cage a la Eichmann. Mm. All right. Eichmann was at least Eichmann had access to his lawyers. He didn't even have access to his lawyers. They had to push a paper back and forth occasionally, but they would not let him in open court. Are they that afraid that he might make a statement that will embarrass or expose something about the system?
My opinion is that it's just a deliberate, extremely cruel demonstration of the crushing power of the state. This you know, tortured individual who, as you recall, he was limping. He wasn't straight. You know, he was plainly in various kinds of physical pain. That by keeping him totally incommunicado, keeping him obviously unable to even communicate with his own defense team during the hearing, it all sends a chilling message to everyone watching, and the whole destruction of Julian by the state is part of that message of showing, you know, this is what the state will do to you if you become a dissident, if you publish our secrets, if you seriously embarrass our foreign policy, you will be destroyed like this. And so, I think it's part of a very cruel piece of theater, basically.
Joe, Dr. Stein, I'm gonna, you get the last question for Craig Murray, and then we're gonna have to wrap it up after that.
Well, on this theme of the cruelty of the state and the rigged process that in which Julian Assange is being persecuted, the assassination plan by the CIA is kind of, another symbol of that. And it lifts the veil in a way that is pretty powerful politically for the public to see what the state is really wanted to do, the state that is trying to get their hands on Julian Assange and lock him up you know, in unique U.S. Torture chambers, basically, where the light of day will never be seen and no one will hear anything from him again. That's who has been planning his assassination. And for Mike Pompeo, who famously told us that, we lie, cheat, steal, and have whole courses in it, you know, he's being subpoenaed now by the court in Spain about this assassination plan. What's the prospects of that and, you know, shifting public opinion, whatever? Do you have any hope that that will have an impact here on this, on this show trial?
Craig?
Well, it's, again, you come down to the stranglehold of the media. Between the mainstream media and the corporate gatekeepers, the internet, they are, they're very able to kill off any story they don't want people to hear. And I think the number of people who know that Pompeo has been indicted by a Spanish court for the attempted assassination of Julian Assange is probably very, very small. And it's actually probably quite difficult to get that information. People can try. I strongly suspect if you Google it won't come up in the Google results. It's very tricky to get these things into public opinion for people to really accept that they happened, when so much effort is being made to keep it out of the public arena. But you're right. I mean, the idea that you're going to extradite somebody to a state that was planning to kill them is plainly ludicrous and illegal. It's completely against international law. But then so much in this case has been ridiculous. I mean, from that same surveillance operation overseen by Pompeo, they spied on all his legal conferences with his lawyers. That would get any other case dismissed by any genuine judge.
Right. Mm-hmm. Craig Murray, I want to thank you so much, Craig Murray. And we got to get you back for the whole hour. And whenever you're settled, Jill Stein, Dr. Stein, tomorrow in Boston at 3 o'clock. We'll be looking for that on Zoom. We'll find you on Twitter where you can get that. And Joe Lawyer will be in New York tomorrow at 1 p.m. along with a lot of people. Roger Waters will be there. The ice cream man, Ben Cohen, will be there. So will Max Blumenthal, and so will Garland Nixon and Margaret Ratner Kunstler, and Chuck Slatkin will be speaking, and many others. You can play that music. This is Craig. We're going to go out with Craig Murray's music. We were going to play this earlier, Craig, but we didn't get you. It was supposed to be the transition music. Now it's the exit music. You are the logical man, Craig Murray. You're the Renaissance man. Please read his book, Secunder Burns. It really is an epic, as is Murder in Samarkand and a Catholic Orangeman in Togo and other places in Africa. Thank you so much, Craig. Good luck. You too, Jill. And you too, Joe Lauria. We'll see you tomorrow. Thank you, everybody, and please show up 1 o'clock, UK Embassy, 47th and 2nd Avenue.